We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now, you may not know her name, but I promise you, you will be inspired by her story. Marilyn Booker is the head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group. She's a veteran of the company, 24 years and going strong. She was in St. Louis to speak at Webster University for their 2019 Diversity and Inclusion Conference. Such a buzz on campus at the prospect of having her here. She is our guest tonight on KMOX Profiles.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Marilyn Booker, it is a joy to have you in St. Louis and moreover to have you here in KMOX.
It is a joy to be in St. Louis and moreover to be a joy be here at KMOX. I'm excited to be here.
So we were joking that I told Marilyn, I said, we're going to talk about your journey. And she said, journey as in? And I said, yes, back to the womb. What was it like? And you mentioned—
I have vivid memories of that, okay?
You need to write a series of books about your vivid memories of being in the womb. We all want to know.
It would be a bestseller, I assure you.
Now, not to sound sexist, but if you've been at Morgan Stanley for more than 24 years, did you start in your 20s? Because you look like you're, you know, a young woman. So has your whole career been at Morgan Stanley?
Well, I actually celebrated my 25th anniversary on January 3rd.
Congratulations.
And I tell people I started when I was 10 because I was a child prodigy. So it's all good. And I did not spend my entire career at Morgan Stanley. It's interesting. I'm actually a lawyer by training.
Ah.
And I'm from Chicago, grew up on the south side of Chicago, went south to Atlanta and attended that great school called Spelman College.
She's a Spelman doll. That's what they call graduates.
That is so true. Loved my school and went back home to Chicago, went to law school, and I practiced law for a number of years. And my very first job, I was a public defender. And
oh,
I represented people who could not afford counsel. And I was stationed on the south side of Chicago. And it was interesting because I think that although I always had a passion for giving back and making a difference and helping people, I think that really kind of put retro rockets on it because that was a time, not that times are drastically different now, but that was a time when a lot of young boys of color were being, pushed through the criminal justice system. And that was problematic. Because I saw them getting to this vicious cycle of crime and poverty, and never being able to get out of it if something didn't happen to disrupt that. They would not be able to get jobs. It would be very difficult for them to go to school. So I spent time, trying to make sure that their rights were protected and that they had good legal representation.
We hear to this day the overload of the public defender. We hear to this day the lack of resources that the public defender has versus the prosecutor. It had to be true then as well.
It was very true then. I would get in the morning and I'd have a stack of cases and I would just work my way through them. But the key is I was dedicated to making sure that regardless of how overloaded, how overworked I was, everybody got my undivided attention because every case was different and everybody had the right to have decent, good, solid legal representation.
And were you able to give it to them, given it seems like that everything was stacked against you?
I think I was. I was very successful. I had a very good trial win rate. I would do a lot of a term of art, motions to suppress evidence, because there were a number of instances where things probably didn't happen the way they should have. And the reality is you've got to be strategic, particularly when you're working with such short time ramifications. So if there's no evidence, there's no case. So you figure out how you can do things that are to the advantage of your client and protecting your client's rights. If things were illegally searched or illegally seized, you have to make sure that that evidence does not get into the trial. And once that evidence goes away, then your clients are in a very different position.
And what was your caseload like sheer numbers?
Oh, I would get probably 15, 20 cases a day.
A day?
Yes.
Different cases a day.
Yes, different cases a day.
So I'm envisioning, you know, like a dry erase board. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you keep it all straight? And how does any public defender today keep it all straight?
You know, I don't know how they do it now, because we really didn't have a whole lot of, you know, computers, and the technology that exists today didn't exist back in the day when I was 3 years old doing this. Remember, I started when I was 10.
She said 10, yes.
But, you know, you have to be organized because one wrong move or one false move could cost somebody their liberty. So you just had to make sure that you kept track of every case. You kept track of the issues in every case. And I kept a lot of notes because that's what kept me organized.
And we also are told that public defenders and those who are forced because of their lack of resources are just pleading everything, whether or not they should. A person who's getting 15, 20 cases a day doesn't have the time, didn't have the dedication or the wherewithal that you appear to have had. So there were just pleas all the time. How did you come against that system?
You know, it's interesting because, again, I don't know kind of how they're doing it now,
because
when I was doing it then. But, you know, I was really fortunate that as a young attorney fresh out of law school, I was assigned to work with a phenomenal attorney who trained me. It really is an apprenticeship, because I was trained on the job. And I was, again, fortunate to work with such great people where that was never an issue, just pleading people out. If it came to a point where we could not do a trial that day, or we felt that we needed to do some research, we would just continue the case. Because we were very focused on doing the right thing. And at the end of the day, it is my humble opinion that if you go to law school and you take on these jobs where you're going to serve the public, you got to serve the public. And you got to do the right thing.
Our guest has spent 25 years at Morgan Stanley. Marilyn Booker is the head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group. She was in town to speak at Webster University at their 2019 Diversity and Inclusion Conference. Coming up next, we're going to talk to her about life in Chicago and life as a college student in Atlanta, Georgia, at the historic Spelman University. That's next on KMOX Profiles.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We are back with Marilyn Booker, and so happy to have her, and so happy as well that Webster University was able to, I think, get you in a little early just so you could come and talk to us here at KMOX. So thank you for rearranging your schedule.
No, absolutely. This is something I would not have missed. I would have walked here if I had to.
And we're going to talk about that for sure, but I do want to take you back to the South Side of Chicago.
For sure.
And the decision to go to Spelman. And for those who don't know, and I imagine a lot don't, Spelman University is an historic college. African-American women, mostly African-American women. There are men who do attend. And so talk to me about growing up on the South Side of Chicago and how many people ask you, did you know Michelle? Do you know Barack?
I get that question all the time. I'll get to that one. OK, but my parents are from Alabama, and they always wanted their kids to go south to college. And I followed my sister and my brother to Atlanta. My sister was at Spelman and my brother was at Morehouse, which was the male college.
Yes.
And although they didn't attend technically Spelman, they took a lot of classes at Spelman, so it was like they were there. And we could take classes at Morehouse as well, which was pretty nice. It was a great experience going to school in Atlanta, going to an all-girls school, going to an historically black college. I developed relationships and friendships with people there who are still some of my closest friends. And it was an interesting experience from the perspective of instilling confidence. There's so many brilliant, talented women there, and it was a safe space for those who may have been a little shy, a little reticent to come into their own. It was a safe space to do that, and so many phenomenal, great leaders have come out of Spelman College, and I do hold that near and dear to my heart. Then I went back to Chicago. I get the question all the time about, did I know Barack and Michelle? Technically speaking, I did not know them, but I knew Michelle's brother very well because Michelle's brother used to work at Morgan Stanley, and we used to do a lot of recruiting activities and recruiting trips together. So I did know the family.
It's interesting to me. What year are we talking that you went to Spelman?
I was there from 19. Oh, they're going to do the math on me if I answer this question.
She's beautiful, people. Go ahead and do the math. It doesn't matter.
In the 80s. How's that?
Okay. And I want to frame that because I remember in the 80s, and I went to an historically, graduated from an historically black university in Jefferson City, Missouri, Lincoln University. And we still to this day have this debate about proper funding from state legislatures. We have the debate about how people feel, both African-Americans mm-hmm. and majority and Caucasian-Americans, about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, whether one is getting a good education, whether I should hire you mm-hmm. because you have or have not gotten a good education. But to know that your parents wanted you to go says something, yes. A, about their commitment and dedication. Mm-hmm. But did you never question it because your brother and sister were there and you believed your parents? And so what do you think of the education you got at Spelman? I know a lot of Spelman dolls, so I know the answer to this.
Phenomenal. I would not change a thing if I had the opportunity to do so. It's interesting that you say that because I remember when I first started working at Morgan Stanley back in the early 90s on Wall Street, there were very few Wall Street firms that were putting a serious effort into recruiting at the historically black colleges. And one of the things that we did at Morgan Stanley was we created this scholarship internship program starting at five of our HBCUs, Spelman, Morehouse, Florida A&M, Howard and Fisk University. And what happened was as we started to bring these very talented young people of color to Wall Street, many of whom probably would never have had an opportunity to get there, but for this program we started, the other firms took notice. And I always say that, the best form of flattery is repetition. So we love people repeating the things we're doing, duplicating the programs we're doing, because a rising tide raises all boats. So we started to get an influx of very talented men and women from the HBCUs. And I think that's kind of when you saw the tide change of not just having more people of color in jobs they traditionally did not have serious representation in, but also the perspective on what do you get out of an HBCU? Is it a good education? Does it match what you're getting from the Ivies? Because all these firms are talking about diversity. Well, you can get diverse, sharp young people from everywhere. But you've got a pool of them at Spelman, a pool of them at Morehouse, a pool of them at Howard, all these other schools that have these very talented people. And you've got to make sure that they have the opportunities that everyone else has, because there's no question about the quality of the education there.
And I know you have to answer this all the time in your position and in your life. To those who feel that we are looking at people, unlike what Dr. King said, we're looking at people based on the color of their skin, and we should not be doing that. And you're giving people their lawsuits over affirmative action, goals that universities have. So what do you say to people who still in 2019 question the path that you created, the program that you created, why there's a need for it, why it's good?
I think you have to educate, because there are many places where what I call an intellectual void exists. And when you encounter that, you have to deal with it and you have to teach people, because a lot of the missteps that we see taking place in our country, if there was a diverse group of folks sitting around the table having a discussion, we wouldn't see those missteps. But when you have people who are all the same, they're thinking the same, they're talking the same, they're walking the same, it's what I call lockstep. And you don't get the creativity that you need to make the best decisions possible. And that's why firms like Morgan Stanley, we're so focused on that, because we know it's not just about the right thing to do. It makes good business sense, because we don't want those missteps. We want to understand everything from every perspective. We live in a melting pot, and we have to respond accordingly. So where people don't get it, you got to teach them.
Well, we're going to find out what she taught, really, at Webster University as a part of its Diversity and Inclusion Conference. Our guest is Marilyn Booker, the head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group. That is next on KMOX Profiles.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We are back, and I'm certain that we could go on for 2 hours. We haven't even scratched the surface, really, with our guest on KMOX Profiles, Marilyn Booker, who for 25 years has worked with Morgan Stanley. She is now the head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group. Let me be clear. When you came to Morgan Stanley initially 25 years ago, what were you doing?
I was the very first diversity director for Morgan Stanley. So I, along with a number of Morgan Stanley colleagues and one of my mentors from Chicago, Jim Lowry, started the first diversity program at Morgan Stanley. And I ran that for 17 years.
I cannot help but think that not everyone was on board.
You know, it's interesting. And I believe this then and I believe this now. It's about the leadership. And this mandate from Morgan Stanley for diversity came from our CEO, Dick Fisher, who passed away a few years ago, and John Mack, who was our president at the time. And they were committed to making a difference and committed to making sure that they did, that our firm did everything possible to support all different types of people coming into our organization.
And what was your message then to Webster University, having done this work at Morgan Stanley for 25 years, what was your message to this internationally known campus? I love Webster University. What was your message to them?
So my message was interesting. It was more of a talk about the state of the state and where we are in America today. And I talked about a tale of two Americas, where there are people who have and there are people who have not. There are people who see light. There are people who are in darkness. There are people who have hope, and there are people who are in despair. When we think about our history, and I talked about our history because we can't figure out where we're going unless we understand the underpinnings of our history, there were basically four stages, or are four stages. One, we went through slavery in this country. Then we moved to Jim Crow laws. Then we moved to civil rights. The fourth and final frontier is economic equality. And I talk about that. Because it's about ownership, and that's what makes a difference. You can't have sustained change if you don't have the resources to do it. And when you look at the spending power that we have in all of our different communities, in the Black community, the Hispanic community, the Asian community, there needs to be commensurate representation at all levels that puts people in positions to make change and make a difference. So I talk about the economic inequality, and I talk about a charge. And I gave people a call to action.
And it was?
To do something about it, to speak up, to be vocal, to educate, to take a stand, to get involved.
And when you choose to speak where you choose to speak, what goes into that for you, the decision making?
You know, I rarely turn down an opportunity to speak. And the reason I rarely turn it down is because I want to share my vision of what I think our country should be. And I want to share my thoughts on how I think people should be involved. I want to educate the younger folk because the younger folk, I think, are thirsty for this information. They're thirsty for knowledge and they're thirsty for guidance. And if I have the opportunity to do that, I do it.
And when you give a charge like that and talking about inclusion, you know, that's a buzzword that some people just they shut down. I mean, I've heard phrases like agitator. I've heard phrases which are historic, right, in terms of the civil rights movement. Race baiting. These are phrases that have been renewed in the American consciousness because of the political debates that continue in this country. Do you feel like we are further apart than ever before? And if so, why?
I think, it's interesting. I think that of late, because of the political discourse that we found ourselves in, I don't think it matters. And I talked about this during my speech. I don't think it matters what your politics are. No one can objectively say that everything's all right in this country. I mean, there's a lot of hatred. There's a lot of evil. There's a lot of distrust. And
you mentioned despair.
Totally. Mm-hmm. A lot of despair in this country. And it's driven by the climate that we found ourselves living in. And I think that's a challenge. So when I talk to people about what are some of the things that they can do to address this, I think we need to have a broad base of support in terms of addressing this. Because if you just have one group talking about it, it can be categorized as you said, race baiting and all these other negative terms. But if you have a broad, diverse group of people on the same page saying, this is not right, we need to make change, we need to have more equality, I think that makes a difference.
It's been said before when we talk a great deal about urban education, for instance, inner city education, that we are really missing the mark in that we are not combining the lack of resources in rural education, which traditionally would be white America, and we're not combining that need to raise the tide for both of those. So when you talk about we need to have a collaboration, I hear that word, of voices, a collaborative sense about this, I feel like that's something that we're missing.
I totally agree, because diversity is not just black and white.
I should have started there probably. What is diversity? Yeah.
You know, it's difference. It's people who are not like what's perceived to be the norm. It could be geographic diversity. It could be economic diversity. I mean, if you are sitting in a room and you have all wealthy people sitting around the table and people who have never really experienced some of the despair that people who weren't born, into that particular, station in life, it's kind of hard to understand the broad picture with what's going on in our country. It's kind of hard to understand the broad picture of whatever you're trying to do. So I think it's very broad. It's about difference. That's how I define it. So it could be race, it's gender, it's sexual orientation, it's disability, it's geographic, it's economic. It is all those different things. You need people from every walk of life to make sure that you're getting a total picture of what you need to address.
We hear so often that diversity is good for business. But there still is then the pushback. So which is it?
I think it's good for business. And the reality is, it doesn't matter, Carol, what you do, you're always going to get pushback. I have rarely, if ever, in my very few years alive, because I'm still very young.
You started at 10.
Because I started at 10. I've rarely ever seen a situation where it was 100% solidarity. There will always be some pushback. But, how do you address that? I think you asked a form of this earlier. You have to have the data. You have to have your facts. And it's kind of hard to argue that you are being subjective, that you are, race baiting and all those other negative terms that come about if you have your facts and you have your data. But there will always be the detractors, but you got to move beyond them. And you can't let them define your goals. You can't let them define your mission. You can't let them deter you from achieving what you know needs to be done.
When you began 25 years ago and Morgan Stanley said, we are going to talk about diversity, we're going to be about diversity, was it in your mind that this immediately is a political statement, this is a political move, this is a political issue?
I always saw it as a business issue. Because, I think that Morgan Stanley was at the cutting edge of really taking the lead in putting diversity into place and talking about it as vocally as we were, because a lot of firms weren't talking about that in the early 90s. And Morgan Stanley did do that. And I think we were able to establish why it was so important from a business perspective. And then, because what started to happen over time is we would start to go and visit clients. And clients would say, we don't want a team of all white males coming in. Not that there's anything wrong with white males. I'm not bashing white men. But our clients would say, we want to see a diverse group of people coming in the room. We value what your white male colleagues have to add. We value that. But we also value what other people who may have a different perspective, we value what they bring to the table. So please make sure we have diverse teams servicing us. And because we were at the forefront of starting to make that happen, we were able to respond.
Well, we're talking, when we say Morgan Stanley, you're talking about wealth management. And so we are going to talk about wealth or the lack thereof. I also want to talk about a little bit about motherhood, because she is a mother of three. I'm the mother of two. And I think that the more we can talk about parenting in America, the better off we all are, no matter what the discussion is. We will come back and wrap up our discussion on KMOX Profiles with Marilyn Booker, head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group. That's next on KMOX.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Well, as I said, I always want to talk about parenting. It was my, I was 9 years old, and the first I remember, Marilyn, that, you know, I want to be a parent. I want to be a mom. I want to be a wife at nine. And so I want to talk about parenting. Mm-hmm. You have a high-profile job. You're in corporate America. You've always had a high-profile job, even as a public defender in Chicago. You're traveling today. You were here for Webster University's Diversity and Inclusion Conference, and you brought one of your sons with you.
I did.
You have three kids. I asked your son, did she drag you? And he gave the proper answer. Well, it's not really been dragged. It's just a chance for me to hang out.
And my kids do love to hang with their mom, so that means I'm maybe just a little bit on the cool side.
You're doing something right. Tell me about your three kids.
So my son who's here with me, Walter, is my oldest. He's 22. And I have two others. My middle child is my daughter. She's the only girl between her and my youngest son, Max. We call her the diva in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Morgan is 21, and my youngest son, Max, is 18.
Well, we have my husband and I have a 19-year-old and a 23-year-old. So we are in that mix together.
Yes.
And I, too, started at 10 years old.
Yes. There you go. I could tell the minute I walked in the studio. OK.
So what I say to my sons, I realize that I am a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Your father and I, our expectations are high. I am very talkative. I have a million questions. I want to know what's going on in your life. And that I know that means that I'm a lot. I imagine that you are a lot. As a mother, that you have high expectations, and that can be very difficult for our children.
My kids sometimes call me a little extra, as my son laughs. Because in spite of the very demanding job, in spite of the very crazy travel, I am very involved in my kids' lives. And I want to know everything from the people they're dating to who they're spending time with, who they're going out with, if they're driving over to someone's house, where they're going, where the car is, because there's a little device on the car that tells me where the car is.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know all of that stuff because particularly to parents who have younger kids, and you can attest to this, the time flies by.
So fast.
It goes by so quickly. And you just don't, that's the one thing we just don't get back. So when they had school plays, and I'm a single mom, by the way, too. So it's a little more challenging,
right.
But you know what? I just make it happen. But when they're, you know, basketball games, soccer games, school plays, parent-teacher conferences, I make it work. Because what I do, going back to when you're asking about the public defender, how you handle all that, it's about being organized.
Right.
I put my kids' lives on my calendar so that I can work around it. And I know what I have to do. As a matter of fact, I'm going to Boston on, my daughter's a junior at Harvard and my son's a freshman at Harvard. And I'm going to Boston on Friday for Parents Weekend. In between all this other work travel that I have to do, you just find a way to make it work.
That is awesome. Well, I take it when you mentioned Harvard that you did do more than one thing right. And hopefully your children are brilliant like you. But I'm so curious
that apple fell right next to my tree.
Right next to the yes. But I'm curious when we talk about wealth management, working in the arena that you do. I go back to the partial government shutdown and the notion that these are government employees. It is a check that generally is guaranteed. And yet we found the majority of Americans, we knew this already, are 30 days, one crisis away, don't have $500 in the bank to handle even a car breakdown. And most car breakdowns are more than $500. Last one I had was $1,700 when my car stopped on the highway on my way home.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk as we wrap this up, though, about when we say wealth management, there's just a lack of wealth.
Yes.
In this country. Some of it is traditional. We know the government did not. The GI Bill did not work for African-American soldiers. The Federal Reserve says that African-Americans who are buying a home, even with similar credit history and similar income and similar job history, are going to face a higher interest rate. We know that Honda paid a hefty fine for charging African-American car borrowers a higher interest rate for no reason other than the fact that they were black. So let's talk about wealth management, a lack thereof, in this country, not just for black people, but for all Americans. We are not saving. We are not. 30 days from a tragedy.
30 days. And as a matter of fact, the number is even more staggering. 61% of Americans could not come up with $1,000.
Oh, my.
If an emergency came about, they'd have to try to figure out, well, do I have any savings? Can I take it out of my retirement? Which there would be a whole host of penalties. And that's another discussion that we could have. They can't come up with $1,000. 33% of Americans do not have any money set aside for retirement.
Any.
And for those who do, the average is between $63,000 and $163,000. I don't know many people who could retire on $163,000.
And people listening to this are, when they hear $163,000, they're salivating because they don't have that.
That's exactly right. But that is, so it's basically you end up working for the rest of your life,
right,
because you can't afford to retire and you are living from paycheck to paycheck. And some of the challenges there is, you know, one of the ones I talk about all the time when I go out in the community and I speak, because people say, well, I don't have a lot of money. It's like, well, you know what? It's not about what you make. It's about what you do with what you make.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to understand, you know, the basics of money management and how to, you know, look at yourself, look at your budget and understand, well, is everything on my budget, everything I'm spending, do I really need to spend that amount of money? Because reality is a lot of people spend more than they make.
Right.
So that tells you right there, you're never going to save if you're spending more than you
make. Our lifestyles are out of whack.
Lifestyles are totally out of whack.
I saw a talk show recently. A woman said she was spending $1,000 a month on her hair.
That's a lot of money.
That's too much money.
Even if you can afford it, that's still a lot of money. And you've got to figure out, you know, what are some of the wants versus what are some of the needs?
Right.
And you have to cut back on the wants so that you can start saving. So people don't save, they don't invest, and they don't work towards getting out of debt and getting out of poverty. And because they don't do that, they are living from paycheck to paycheck.
So when you say to people, because I bet you do, $5, $10,
that's exactly right.
That's what you say, right?
That's what I say. We have kind of a rule of thumb in the industry where we say you should save 10% of your net income. But when I have my discussions in the community, I'm talking to people, I say, you may not be able to do 10% because this thing called life has a way of getting in the way.
Right.
But do 5%, do 2%, do 1%. It adds up. I do a lot of work with children. And when I talk to them about saving, I tell them, if you were to save $7 a week, within 20 years, you'd have almost $4,000 or $5,000, because I show them the calculations on how this wonderful thing called compound interest works and their money grows. So imagine if you could save $50 a week or $100 a week. When I work with adults, I have a chart that shows them if you take a $10,000 lump sum investment and you put it away and you get an average return, which means what your money earns, of 8% over 30 years, you would have over $100,000. 50 years, you'd have close to $500,000. And that's just $10,000. So imagine if somebody saved $5 here, $10 there, $100 to get up to that number and then put it away. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to. We have to change the discussion or the dialogue from one of consumption to one of investing and saving.
Let us change the dialogue from one of consumption to one of saving. Now, this is a woman who, I know my husband thinks I have too many purses and too many shoes, but I have a 401k. I am saving. She put the one finger up. Yes, on the 401k?
Yes, absolutely.
Take advantage.
And if your firm has a matching program, please contribute up to the max, because that's free money. And billions of dollars are left on the table every year because people do not contribute to their 401ks to the max of their firm's contribution.
Thank you so much for that. That encouragement, really. It's encouragement. People, you can do this.
That's true.
You can absolutely do it.
It is not impossible. People who may not have huge and large means, they may never become millionaires, but they can certainly put themselves in a position to live a comfortable financial life. And that should be the objective.
Marilyn Booker, the head of the Morgan Stanley Urban Markets Group, So glad she was able to come here to KMOX to St. Louis, spend some time with us. A joy talking to you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Carol. Thank you so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed our discussion.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.